Get 15% off a set of BrakeBest Select, Select Pro, or Import Direct brake pads and two rotors now at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Hello and welcome to Dining with Death, True Crime Tuesday. It's that time of year again. The grocery stores are full of pink and red boxes full of chocolates and white teddy bears holding hearts. And florists all over the country are preparing for their busiest day of the year. I'll start this episode off with an admission. Valentine's Day is my least favorite holiday of the year. I think it's because I don't care for the idea that romantic behavior should be forced on one particular day of the year. People that are never romantic are forced to make gestures they wouldn't otherwise make, and then they feel like, well, you know, I got that out of the way, which is not romantic. And then, of course, others are left feeling sad and left out, that they don't have anyone to make any kind of a gesture for them. I just don't really care for it. For a time, when my kids were little, I really loved making their Valentine's boxes for school so they could take their little decorated box with them and pass out and receive, you know, their little Valentines from their classmates. But then they got too old to do that. And honestly, them growing out of that kind of made me dislike Valentine's Day even more. But my personal Valentine's woes are nothing in comparison to the people who lived through the infamous event we are going to talk about today. This is the case of the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. Let's get into it. May 11th, 1920. A little bit of mafia history is needed to understand the dynamics that led to the massacre we will be discussing today. Diamond Jim Colosimo, the Chicago mafia boss whose life and murder I covered on my flagship playlist, Dining with Death, he is murdered in Chicago. When a mafia leader dies, it creates a flurry of activity within those criminal organizations. Someone new is put in charge, and as that new leader moves up, there are other spots that need to be filled. In this case, Johnny Torrio is moved up into the position of boss after Diamond Jim is killed. Johnny Torrio then promotes his right-hand man, Al Capone, to next in charge. Al Capone is ruthless. He's not the most intelligent mobster, but he's street smart. In the decades after his death, rumors of his viciousness have flourished. But if you really look into who Al Capone was, he was a bit of a wuss by mafia standards. He always had other people do his dirty work, or he got out of it altogether by being cunning enough to talk his way out of it. He was a very vain man who was very, very self-conscious about the large scar on his face, the scar that was the result of a man slashing his face with a razor after Al Capone insulted this man's sister. In many photos, you see Al Capone holding up a handkerchief as though he's wiping sweat off of his face. But in actuality, he was known to pretend to wipe his brow when he saw a camera come out so that he could use the handkerchief to block the scar from the camera. And if you're not a mafia fan and you don't already know this, Al Capone was called Scarface, a nickname which he loathed. Capone was a pretty decent businessman, and he knew how to throw his weight around in order to make money through threats and intimidation. This was a very tumultuous time in the U.S., and as Al Capone rose to power, the laws about alcohol were changing. On December 5th, 1920, Prohibition went into effect, which legally banned the sale and possession of alcohol. This era lasted for 13 years until 1933, and during those 13 years, Al Capone made millions and millions of dollars for the mafia and for himself as a bootlegger, supplying illegal alcohol to underground speakeasies all over Chicago and even into Canada and New York. In January of 1925, Johnny Torrio is shot several times, and that's it for him. He survives, but he is finished being the mob boss. He kind of wants out. He sort of officially makes Al Capone acting boss, but in 1927, Capone is made the official boss when Vincent Drucci, leader of Capone's rival Northside gang, is shot and killed, and Capone is then officially promoted to the highest spot in his organization. The Roaring Twenties was filled with violence, daytime shootings, hijackings, illegal liquor sales, and on top of that, the North and South sides of the Chicago Mafia were at war with each other. Several events, including the murder of Dean O'Banion, a North Side leader, would increase the already high tension between the North and South gangsters. Then, like I said earlier, Torrio is shot and he survives, but his shooting only served to fuel the flames of anger between the two groups. In September 1926, the North Side targeted Al Capone himself. Capone and his crew were having lunch at the Hawthorne Hotel in Cicero. Six cars drove by and blasted thousands of bullets through the glass windows of the restaurant. A North Side mobster named Frank Guzenberg then jumped out of the car and unloaded a 100-round drum from a Tommy gun into the hotel. Al Capone miraculously survived this attempt on his life, and when he did, angry wasn't the word. He was incensed, and he was going to get revenge on the gang that tried to end his life. October 1926. 28-year-old Jaime Weiss, a Northside gangster, was gunned down by two of Capone's men. This made way for the rise of Bugs Moran, who took control of the Northside group. Then again, Vincent Drucci was murdered, and the situation just got more and more tense. One police officer later recalled, "We all knew it was coming. We knew something big and something bad was going to happen. It had to. These guys were at war." The final straw broke in 1928 when a couple of events unfolded. The first was when Jack Machine Gun McGurn, Capone's friend, survived several attempts on his life. And the second was when Bugs Moran partnered up with Capone's rival, Joe Aiello. Al Capone was feeling kind of backed into a corner. They'd almost killed his best guy, and then they'd teamed up to take him down. Something had to be done, and it had to be done soon. Machine Gun Jack began very carefully planning the South Side's move. He learned that the North Side gang's headquarters was SMC Cartage Company, located at 2122 North Clark Street. Once Jack knew where the gang spent most of their time, it gave him an idea. Jack said that he and Capone's other hitmen should dress up like policemen and pretend they were performing a raid on the headquarters. Jack brought in hitmen from out of town so none of the Northside guys would recognize them dressed as cops. Al Capone liked this plan and he gave his okay to go ahead with it. So Jack McGurn then stole a police car and several police uniforms. They were going to take out Bugs Moran and his best guys. Jack then contacted a local booze hijacker, a bootlegger, that was friendly with Bugs Moran and told him to tell Moran that he had obtained a shipment of Old Log Cabin whiskey and he would sell the case of whiskey to Bugs for $57 a case. These secretive meetings where liquor was bought and sold, that was the way people got their alcohol back then. The bootlegger, who was in on it, set the time and place to meet Bugs Moran and his men with the promise of whiskey. February 14, 1929. As a light dusting of snow fell on the city streets, and bakers and candy makers and florists all over the city prepared for the onslaught of customers out to purchase sweets and trinkets and flowers for their Valentines, seven people, all with the Northside Chicago Mafia, arrived at their gang headquarters, and Al Capone's men were watching. The Northside gangsters at this meetup were Frank Guzenberg, Pete Guzenberg, John May, Albert Weinschenk, James Clark, Adam Heyer, and Dr. Reinhard Schwimmer. Five of the seven men were Northside mobsters. The Guzenbergs were enforcers. Adam Heyer was the bookkeeper and business manager. James Clark was Moran's second in command. And Albert Weinschenk ran some of Moran's businesses. John May was the gang's car mechanic. And Dr. Schwimmer was an optician who had given up his medical practice to become a mafia man. It was an interesting time, to say the least. All of these men, except the mechanic, were well-dressed in their suits, ties, tie pins, and street shoes. One of them even wore a fresh carnation on his lapel. Now, at this time, Al Capone believed that one of the men to be present that day at the liquor sales exchange was to be Bugs Moran himself, but that didn't turn out to be the case. Albert Weinschenk resembled Bugs Moran, and he even dressed similar to him. So when Capone's men, who were waiting, saw Albert enter the building, they mistook him for Bugs Moran. Now, Bugs Moran was planning on attending this meeting, but he was running late. He lingered in his Parkway Hotel apartment just a few minutes longer than usual, and he was running behind. Sometimes being late saves your life. This building that served as the headquarters for the Northside Gang had a garage, and the gang would often stand around in that garage near their vehicles. Johnny May, the mechanic, lay on his back under a jacked-up truck repairing a wheel. The other six men were milling about, trying to stay warm on the cold morning. As the gangsters waited for what they thought would be the arrival of the bootlegger with the cases of whiskey to sell them, two of Al Capone's hitmen walked into the garage dressed as policemen. Two other hitmen waited in the large black Cadillac outside, but the Northside gangsters did not see them. The two hitmen dressed as police officers lined the seven gang members up against the wall and forced them to face that wall. Now, the gang members didn't fight or object to this because during this era, it was very common for police to raid known gang locations. The gang members figured this was just another raid and it would be over soon. They readily handed over their weapons, as they always did when the police made their presence known. As the first two hitmen, the ones in the police uniforms, took the last of their weapons from the Northside gangsters, the two additional hitmen waiting in the car emerged. Both of them were carrying Tommy guns, with the seven Northside gang members facing the wall, unarmed and helpless. Al Capone's men cowardly opened fire, blasting hundreds of rounds into their backs. The gangsters began to fall one by one. Each man ended up with around 15 bullets in him. Two of the men had been finished off with a shotgun. The gunfire was so pervasive that some of the men's heads, arms, and legs were severed by bullets. I would love to show you the fascinating crime scene photos of this event that are shown literally in history class, but I can't here. Capone's men ran from the scene as police sirens grew closer to the sound of the gunfire. When police arrived, Frank Guzenberg was still alive. Now, the legend is the police asked him, "Who shot you?" And staying true to the code of silence, Guzenberg replied, "Nobody shot me." But I actually found differing accounts that said a policeman named Thomas J. Loftus was first on the scene, and he leaned over Frank and said, "Do you know me, Frank?" And Frank replied, "Yeah, you're Tom Loftus," and then said, "I won't talk." But then after taking a large breath, Frank said, "Cops did it," and then said, "For God's sake, get me to the hospital." So as with all the mafia stories, we might never get the real truth on those details, but Frank was taken to the hospital and he died there hours later. The rest of the gangsters were dead at the scene. Police started to look around the area for witnesses. They found a couple of witnesses, but all of those witnesses told the police that all they had seen was two police officers walking out of the building with two other guys who had their hands up in front of their faces. It looked to them as though the police were leading the two other men at gunpoint. The witnesses said they got into a large black Cadillac and drove away. The plan had been executed to perfection. The only survivor of the shooting was a German shepherd named Highball, who belonged to the gang mechanic John May. Poor Highball was tied up and trapped under a beer truck, covered in blood and shell casings and howling when the police arrived. Now, remember, Bugs Moran was supposed to be there, but he was late. And he pulled up to the scene just as the police cars did, and catching a glimpse of all the commotion, he had his driver quickly pull away. He had escaped being murdered simply because he was running late. He had his driver take him to a nearby coffee shop to kind of watch the scene from a close distance. Now, where was Al Capone during this horrible event? Sunning himself at his Florida mansion. He made sure he was far, far away when the murders took place. Everyone from mobsters on the north and south sides to cops to everyday citizens were sure that Al Capone had ordered the massacre. Now, just a little disclaimer here. This is the official story of what happened that day, according to the majority of mob historians. I know, I am well aware that people have other ideas of what went on that day. So, you know, feel free to comment with your ideas. I always love to hear from you guys, but maybe refrain from calling me names and telling me that I'm an idiot because I got this wrong. This is the official story. Just stay calm. It's okay. Thanks in advance. People get very passionate about these mafia stories. With all of his main guys dead, Bugs Moran was left essentially alone. Jaime Weiss and Vincent Drucci, his former leaders, had been killed. And now almost all of his trusted associates were dead as well. But his loss and Capone's victory turned out to have massive unintended consequences. Over the years, the public had grown tired of the violence. Al Capone was once a hero. He was a loved and lauded local figure who signed autographs at baseball games and posed for photos with people's kids. But all that had changed. People now saw Al Capone as a menace. They were tired of their shops, their friends' shops, and businesses being destroyed by acts of violence. They were tired of worrying about their children walking to school and playing in the streets. They were tired of the mafia, and they were tired of Al Capone. This terrible act of violence served as the tipping point against the mob. The public had had enough, and they demanded action. Within days of the St. Valentine's Day massacre, Al Capone received a summons to testify before a Chicago grand jury on charges of federal prohibition violations. They knew they couldn't yet get him on the massacre, but they knew they could get him on prohibition charges. Al Capone, who famously always feigned illness whenever he was in trouble, said he was too unwell to attend any type of proceedings, and so they were delayed. Al Capone was proving to be just as slippery and evasive as he had always been. February 22, 1929. Police are called to the scene of a garage fire on Wood Street. They found a 1927 Cadillac disassembled and partially burned, and they determined that this was the black car used by the killers during the massacre. Now, there is a big, long story about how they traced the serial number of the car to a dealer in Michigan, that it was sold to men using fake names. But the bottom line is, in a very roundabout way, the car did have ties to known associates of Al Capone. After weeks of investigation, the police announced that they suspected the gunmen to be John Scalise, Albert Anselmi, Frank Rio, and machine gun Jack McGurn, all of whom were known to be Al Capone's hitmen. But as is so often the case in mafia stories, some of these men decided they were going to kill Al Capone. They turned on him, and he ends up having them murdered for turning against him. So as the investigation into the St. Valentine's Day massacre drags on, Capone has John Scalise and Albert Anselmi, along with another man named Joseph Guinta, killed. Police did eventually charge machine gun Jack McGurn with murder, but they just couldn't find enough evidence to proceed to trial, and they ended up dropping those murder charges against him. The case stalled for months, but in December of 1929, police got a break. There was a raid conducted in Michigan at a bungalow occupied by a man calling himself Frederick Dane. Well, this man turned out to be using an alias. He was actually Fred Burke, who was known as Killer, that was his mafia name, and police had long suspected that Burke had a lot to do with this massacre. During this raid, cops found a large trunk containing a bulletproof vest, around $320,000 in bonds recently stolen from a bank. They found machine guns, they found other guns, and they found lots of ammunition. The Chicago police were notified of the finding, and their investigators asked that the Tommy guns they found be brought to their laboratory because they had some brand new science called forensic ballistics. I find this stuff fascinating. You guys know that. You don't think of the 1920s being a very advanced period of time, forensically, at least I don't, but they were in fact starting to develop some forensic techniques that were quite evolved. They run these two machine guns through the ballistic testing they had available to them at the time. And yes, they were the two machine guns that fired all those bullets at the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. They never suspected Burke was one of the gunmen, and they don't catch him during this raid, but he does end up getting convicted for a separate murder, and he dies in prison for that separate murder. Now, not only was this massacre one of the worst mafia mass murders in history, but it's this very important link to the beginnings of ballistic firearms testing that makes it so significant in true crime history. It's fun to talk about the mafia and the Roaring Twenties and all of that, but for us true crime lovers, this is an important case because it does very directly tie into the forensics that have helped solve so many cases that we all study and like to learn about. Back then, they had high-up military men, firearms experts, that kind of started this new type of science, studying the striations and markings left on a bullet from the barrel of the particular gun that that bullet came out of. A man named Calvin Hooker Goddard, who was a colonel in the U.S. Army, was a very important and pivotal figure in forensic ballistics. In 1925, he wrote an article for the Army Publications where he speaks about the ability to compare, under a microscope, the tool marks left there during manufacturing to striations left on bullets and casings fired from those exact weapons. At the time, this was very groundbreaking stuff, and if you're like me, it's still very fascinating. Colonel Goddard is really credited as being the pioneer of ballistic forensics. He was the head of the American Bureau of Forensic Ballistics, the first ever organization for studying this type of science, and he partnered with the FBI on many very famous cases. FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover actually urged all of his FBI agents to subscribe to the publications that were put out by Colonel Goddard's organization, and he asked that they study and understand as best they could this new form of science. It's really amazing and cool when you think back on all of these people throughout history that we've never heard of, but that had such a huge impact on modern life, modern science, modern understanding that we have today because of their work so long ago. Now, the other thing that I want to point out is that Colonel Goddard was, you know, very anti these type of weapons in the hands of citizens. Despite what a lot of people believe about the Second Amendment, it does not entitle you to own any weapon that you want. And Colonel Goddard, this military person, this father of forensic ballistics, he was very adamant that these type of weapons stay out of the hands of the public. You know, the Second Amendment was written kind of a long time ago when they were talking about one bullet, one shot, a musket. Things have changed since then, and our gun laws need to catch up. So not only was Colonel Goddard very instrumental in forensic ballistics, but also in persuading Franklin D. Roosevelt to outlaw the Tommy gun. So they've got the guns, two of the suspected gunmen are dead at the hand of their former ally, and they can't put a case together against the other two suspected gunmen. Authorities try for months and then years, but they were never able to solve this case, to answer the question, who committed the St. Valentine's Day Massacre? The case remains officially unsolved. Now, of course, we all know who was behind it and why it happened, but in a court of law, it's not about what common knowledge is or what everyone believes, it's about what you can prove, and they just couldn't prove anything. The case will most likely always remain a mystery. A lot of historians call this event the coldest case, and it is very, very cold. However, a new Al Capone biographer has uncovered fresh information which implicates a different suspect, a forgotten Chicago criminal with a very simple and timeless motive: revenge. Now, if you choose to believe this theory, it completely negates a lot of what I have said in this episode, which is, like I said, the official story of the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. If you believe this new theory, it changes, well, it kind of changes everything. In this theory, that statement made by Frank Guzenberg, you know, when he said cops did it, takes on a different meaning. Maybe it was actual cops that did it. In this theory, the police considered Bugs Moran himself to be the planner of the massacre. He wasn't running late for the meeting. He wasn't there because he knew what was going to happen. Moran's gang had stolen a truckload of liquor from a crooked cop, and the theory is that the crooked cop lost so much because of that theft that he set out to take out revenge on the Moran gang. This theory is that this cop planned and carried out the execution of the gang members simply because he was getting revenge on them from stealing from him. One of the lead investigators on this massacre was a man named David Stansbury, and he seemed to believe something very different from what has become the official story. He told the press, "I can name 50 motives for this crime, but no one stands out as being important enough to be called the probable cause of the murders." Behind the scenes, Stansbury told associates that he didn't believe Al Capone had even been involved. When machine gun Jack McGurn was asked about the massacre by a reporter for the Evening Post, he said, "Me? Mixed up in that gang killing? Don't make me laugh. The Guzenberg boys would have plugged me if they saw me a block away." Now, there's a lot of truth to that statement. These guys were, like I said, at war. They knew each other. If Jack McGurn was there, he most certainly wasn't one of the men dressed as a police officer because the Northside gang members would have immediately recognized him. Now, there's a problem with this theory. Say it was a few bad cops out for revenge. Wouldn't they have made it look like the gang pulled out their weapons and they had to shoot them all in self-defense? Wouldn't they go out of their way to make it look like it was not a gangland-style execution, but instead an exchange of fire between police and gangsters? Or would they have intentionally made it look like a gangland shooting because people would assume it was just gang-on-gang violence and never suspect it was the cops? But if that was the case, why would they be dressed in their police uniforms? See, this throws a big wrench into a lot of aspects of this case, but there are a lot of people who buy into this separate theory. And so, of course, I had to include it today in our discussion of this infamous event. So what's the bottom line here? The bottom line is that this is one of the most infamous and most important events in American crime history. Yes, it was brutal. Yes, it was vicious. Yes, it remains officially unsolved. But those might be the lesser important lessons to take away. This case was the beginning of the end of the powerful Chicago crime families. Al Capone ends up dying of heart failure in 1947 after contracting syphilis and spending time at Alcatraz before being released to die at home. Bugs Moran ends up dying in prison with about $100 to his name, and Herbert Hoover, the newly elected president, was bound and determined to put an end to all of this violence. He ran on an anti-crime platform, and he did try to make good on a lot of his campaign promises. He was very tough on crime, and he was instrumental in helping to put an end to the daily violence that plagued Chicago. Now, of course, there is a lot more to this and to every mafia story. Every time I post a mafia episode, I get lots and lots and lots of comments about how I missed this or I got that wrong. That's okay. People who are into the mafia have big opinions on these cases, and that's great. I'm still going to bring you my version of the stories, and those versions will be based on what the accepted version of the story is. You can take or you can leave what I have to say about them. And again, this case was really important as it served as a testing ground for the infancy, the beginning of forensic ballistics, a science that has gone on to solve thousands of murder cases. Regardless of where you stand on the mafia and the characters who were involved, love them or hate them, there is never any denying that they shaped the American crime story and they shaped American justice forever. the mafia will always have a place in the history of true crime. Thank you for joining me today on Dining with Death, True Crime Tuesday. I hope you're well, and I hope that you have a happy Valentine's Day. Thanks for spending a few minutes with me today. Stay safe and be kind to each other, and I'll see you next time on Dining with Death. Bye.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.